Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 244 in Victorian popular fiction author H. Rider Haggard features as one of the main characters of this tale. Rider Haggard's creation called Alan Quatermain appeared in 18 novels, the first in what has become known as the Lost World genre. George Lucas and Philip Kaufman copied the Alan Quatermain template for Indiana Jones characters, as well as the basic storylines for movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark. While King Solomon's Mines is Rider Haggard's most popular work, Alan Quatermain has since reappeared in movies and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which gave his books a bit of a push. His novels, which blended exploration, myth, and early ideas of evolution, also influenced the subconscious of his generation, resonating with spiritual and psychological themes that were explored by figures like Jung and Freud. Furthermore, his work reflects and grapples with late Victorian anxieties, including imperial politics, the changing role of religion, and burgeoning notions of race and empire. Right now, we're saddling up with a real character, Theophilus Shepstone, in Pietermaritzburg. It's 1877. He's not going to a lost world. He's going to a world newly found. If you recall last episode, Transvaal President Burgers had gone to war against Bapedi chief Sekukuni, which ended in a stalemate and reports of atrocities committed by German mercenaries. Burgers had already complained in England about their treatment of the Boer claims to the diamond fields, and the colonial office had coughed up £90,000 as compensation. You could call it a bribe, because that's what it was. The Boers accepted the compensation, but did not back down on their claims to land in the vicinity of the Transvaal, including Bapedi land. Back in England, it was decided by colonial officials that it was time to make an example of the Boers of the Transvaal. Colonial Secretary Lord Carnarvon had plans for the South Africans to join a confederation, and President Thomas Francois Burgers appeared receptive to the idea. This sounds bizarre because there were going to be two wars between the British and the Boers over Boer independence, but we'll get there at the right time. As long as the Transvaal remained receptive to the confederation idea, at least in Carnarvon's mind, there was no real conflict to deal with amongst the local officials. But there was growing tension between an historian, J.J. Froude, and Carnarvon's emissary, Sir Garnet Wolseley. Froude had been sent on a fact-finding mission to the colonies by Carnarvon, and he'd become a surprising advocate for the Boers and the Free State and Transvaal Republics. He was highly impressed by the Boers' strong sense of independence and felt they had been unfairly treated by Britain, particularly over the annexation of the diamond fields around Griqualand West. Froude believed that any union or confederation of the South African states had to be entirely voluntary and could not be imposed by force or pressure from London. After his visits to South Africa in 1874 and 75, Froude was convinced that Britain should respect the Transvaal's independence granted by the Sunt River Convention. He argued that if the Transvaal entered a confederation, it must be of their own seeking, without the least attempt at pressure. His advice to Carnarvon was to let the states handle their own problems, as they resented interference from Downing Street. Cape Governor Sir Henry Barclay had been sending Carnarvon reports drawn largely from pro-annexationist newspapers in the Transvaal and the Cape Colony. These implied that the Transvaal was nearing a state of anarchy as a result of its war with Sekukuni's Bapedi. He also mentioned the petitions from groups of English citizens living in the Transvaal asking for the British to annex the Boer territory because they claimed the Transvaal government was unable to maintain order. Burgers was trying to destroy the Bapedi, they said, so that the Boers could extract taxes from Sekukuni in order to build their railroad to Delagoa Bay. Barclay hinted at a power struggle between President Francois Burgers, a man he called emotionally unstable, and former President Pretorius. Actually, what was happening was a future president, Paul Kruger, was the real source of political friction in the Transvaal. Eagerly lapping all this up was Sir Garnet Wolseley, who was the very epitome of the stiff upper lip Brit, a military officer and administrator representing the opposite, more interventionist imperial view. Wolseley was sent to Natal by Carnarvon to supervise governmental restructuring in anticipation of the Confederation scheme. His actions and overall philosophy aligned with the policy of aggressive imperial consolidation and the use of British strength to achieve political goals. Wolseley was moved to act when Burgers and the Transvaal Volksraad rejected Confederation and let it be known that they were indeed seeking to build a railway to the Portuguese at Delagoa Bay. The tipping point came when Barclay sent a telegraph to Carnarvon that 9 Boers had been killed in a skirmish with the Bapedi, which was true, and that Burgers had now lost control of the situation, which was not. Carnarvon asked Theophilus Shepstone, who was in London for a conference called to discuss Confederation, to return to South Africa and investigate conditions in the Transvaal. Thus his departure from Pietermaritzburg. British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli had a nickname for Carnarvon, Twitters. Twitters explained his reasoning process this way. Matters are extremely critical. I have received information that a meeting has already been called by a certain part of the people to ask for our intervention and to take over the government of the country. Some even of the Dutch authorities appear to be consenting parties. We have hunted high and low for these Dutch authorities as consenting parties as historians, but they do not exist. The British tried to perpetuate the Transvaal's weakness until Boer conditions improved in the months between October 1876 and April 1877. The serious reverse, reported by Barclay to Carnarvon in September, was followed by a series of successful Boer operations. By October, Burgers could write to Bulwer, Lieutenant Governor of Natal, that in the reference to the Sekakuni matter, I am happy to say that there is every prospect of a successful suppression of the rebellion, which will, I sincerely hope, tend to secure peace for the future and prevent the recurrence of disturbances. In February 1877, Sekakuni came to terms with the Boers. The war ended. Clearly then, the weakness of the Transvaal, which Carnarvon hoped would compel the population by and large to voluntarily cede the government to the British, did not exist. Wolseley and Carnarvon decided on the extreme move of forcibly annexing the Transvaal in April 1877, based on the fact that the Boers were growing stronger, not weaker. Theophilus Shepstone would be sent from Maritzburg, and according to Wolseley's logic, the annexation would be seen as a necessary step to secure the region. A logical step. Froude's advice was ultimately ignored, leading to the 1877 annexation, which itself would lead directly to the First Anglo-Boer War of 1880 and 81, which goes to show never argue with an historian. In late December 1876, Sir Theophilus Shepstone departed from Maritzburg in Natal with a small, almost symbolic escort of just 25 Natal mounted police and a handful of officials, including young H. Rider Haggard. Just as an aside, Haggard was not being paid for his duties as Shepstone's secretary. Work experience, I guess you'd call it. Shepstone's official mission, under a special commission from the British Colonial Secretary, Carnarvon, was to investigate the dire state of the Transvaal. When he first entered the country in January 1877, he spent much time travelling among the villages along the road from Newcastle to Pretoria, talking to people and assessing their feelings about the viability of the state. His attentions were directed towards people predisposed towards annexation, merchants and English subjects. However, Shepstone's secret instructions were far more decisive. If he deemed it necessary and opportune, he was to annex the territory to the British crown. The rationale, which was going to be trumpeted to the public, was that the unstable Boer Republic posed a threat to the stability of the entire region, jeopardizing British interests and the broader plan for South African Confederation. Shepstone's small party arrived in Pretoria on January 22, 1877, not as an invading army, but as a diplomatic mission. For nearly 3 months, he engaged in discussions with Transvaal President Burgers and other officials, arguing that only British intervention could save the state from financial collapse and external threats, particularly from the powerful Zulu kingdom to the east. Many Burgers were fiercely independent, but the government appeared paralysed, and Shepstone's quiet, confident pressure combined with the Republic's internal political crises, created an atmosphere of inevitability. In March, the Volksraad convened, and Burgers, who by now was under internal political pressure from Paul Kruger, agreed to reforms which could stabilise the Transvaal government. Boer public opinion had also affirmed that the country should resolve its own weaknesses without the help of the British. On April 12, 1877, Shepstone formally proclaimed the annexation of the Transvaal in Pretoria's Church Square, and President Burgers resigned on the same day, to be replaced by Paul Kruger. Over the next 3 years, Kruger would lead two separate deputations to London to try to have the annexation overturned. The annexation then was carried out without bloodshed. The ceremonial hoisting of the British flag, the Union Jack, took place a few weeks later on May 24, 1877, which was Queen Victoria's birthday. This symbolic act cemented British authority over the new territory. Rider Haggard was nominated for the job because the official who had been tasked had lost his voice. This experience profoundly shaped Rider Haggard's views on the British Empire, the Boers, and the Zulu, themes that would dominate his later literary and political writings. Haggard later described the moment as one of the proudest moments of his life. That act was not just ceremonial, it symbolized the assertion of British sovereignty over the former Boer Republic, making visible what had previously been a political proclamation. So in short, Haggard participated in the formal assertion of this rule, stepping in to help raise the flag in the public ceremony when protocol required it. After annexation, Haggard remained in the Transvaal. He was appointed as the Master and Registrar of the High Court in the new British administration of the Transvaal, a responsible position for a 20-year-old. So you could say that the annexation of the Transvaal whet the youngster's appetite for adventure. Those years fed directly into his first book. Back in England, he sat down to write a documented non-fiction account of the region's politics called Cetshwayo and His White Neighbours, published in 1882, explicitly compiled from official blue books to ensure accuracy. Only after that did the adventure fiction arrive, King Solomon's Mines in 1885, followed by Alan Quatermain and She, all rooted in people and places he'd known in Southern Africa. Shepstone, meanwhile, had been declared administrator of the Transvaal. His administration faced serious challenges. The Transvaal had no easy revenue base, and Shepstone introduced new taxes on both black and white Transvaalers, while his administrative reforms chafed the Boers. They now had no elected representation under British rule, and resistance started almost immediately. Future episodes are going to deal with these bloody tidings. Time to stand back and look at a few other things happening between 1875 and 1877. The country was developing. Prime Minister John Multina's government in the Cape began constructing two railway lines from Port Elizabeth and Uitenhage. The Verlatenskloof Pass in the Roggeveld Mountains was completed. In 1877, Cape Colony railway lines included the Western Line from Salt River to Wynberg and the extension to Worcester, the Midland Line, which included Addo to St. Flats, and the Eastern Line, expanding from East London to King Williamstown. The line between Cape Town and Wellington was also under government control and being extended westward through the Hex River Valley. The Cape Western Line was charted by Prime Minister Multina himself, armed with a map, a pen and a ruler. Cape Town was cut off from the Highland interior by a triple barrier of steep mountain ranges, but where there's a will, there's a way, and progressed fast inland once the primary obstacle of the Hex River Mountains was overcome in 1876 with a major system of bridges and tunnels. 1876 also saw the building of a new central station for Cape Town, and over the next few years, the line rapidly extended through the Karoo Desert to the towns of Beaufort West, Daar, and on to Kimberley. It was the diamonds of Kimberley and the consequent rush that started in 1871 that had given impetus to the development of railways across South Africa. The government's 1872 plan, when they hauled it out, was to strike northwards from the three ports of Cape Town, Port Elizabeth and East London towards Kimberley and the developing hinterland. They were intended to bring the towns of Southern Africa's vast territory into direct railway connection with the country's ports, thus driving development of the interior and building an export economy. In 1877, The Natal Government Railways acquired the Natal Railway Company for the sum of £40,000, gaining the line from the Point to Durban and from Durban to Mgani. This move, inspired in part by Molteno's Grand Cape Government Railways, was intended to drive the extension of Natal's railways inland towards the Drakensberg and eventually the Orange Free State. The Natal Government Railways also adopted the track gauge known as the Cape Gauge. That's 3 foot 6 inches wide, or 1.067 millimeters. Apart from the Point to Durban and Durban to Mgani line, there was a 126-kilometer line planned from Durban to Maritzburg, as well as one along the Natal South Coast near Isipingo, then a fourth along the North Coast to Verulam. All of these were going to cost a cool £1.2 million, funded by London loans. That's worth about £150 million today. One more note in this episode, and it's full of smoke and irony. The South African International Exhibition of 1877 was Cape Town's own World Fair, and a grand display of empire and invention staged beneath a vast glass and iron pavilion that nodded to London's Crystal Palace. It stood proudly on the grounds of the Freemasons' Lodge de Goedehoop, then serving as the Cape Parliament as well, a fitting symbol of optimism, industry, and borrowed splendour. 15 years later, that optimism went up in smoke. The exhibition hall, the Masonic Lodge, and the Native Affairs Office burned to the ground in 1892, a small bonfire of colonial vanities. A century and more passed. Then in 2022, another fire consumed South Africa's Parliament, this time allegedly lit by a lone and troubled man. The echoes are uncanny. History, it seems, likes to warm its hands over familiar flames. We're told a new parliament will rise by April 2026 at a cost of 2 billion rand. For that, you could have built South Africa's entire railway network in the 1870s. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform that helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog. There's updates about episodes, and you can email me from there. Until next, goodbye.